This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Art is usually considered a matter of personal taste, but what if it's in public or paid for with public funds? One of the most visible forums for playing out America's culture wars is in public art. That, according to Michael Kamen, a professor of American history and culture at Cornell University. In his new book, Visual Shock, Kamen takes readers through a history of American cultural disputes, from the first monuments and memorials on the National Mall to a sculpture called Tumbling Woman, a bronze statue of a contorted upside-down figure intended to commemorate those who died leaping from the World Trade Center. Throughout American history, says Professor Kamen, art controversies have pushed the limits of taste and helped define what is deemed acceptable in public. Art controversies and what they tell us about American culture is the talk of the nation. Later this hour, there's a new approach to teaching math. Less is more. But first, art controversies. What kind of art is appropriate for a democratic society, and what does our art say about us? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is talk@npr.org. Michael Kamen joins us now from Cornell University Educational Television Center in Ithaca, New York. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor Kamen.
Glad to be with you.
What do these controversies over public art, what do they reveal about our culture, our society?
Well, they reveal many different things. They reveal that Americans have been fairly resistant to modernism. They reveal that Americans have been very ambivalent about whether they should look to Europe and the old world for criteria and standards of excellence in art, or whether somehow distinctively American qualities of art should be sorted out, figured out, and displayed in our art to start with.
You call your book Visual Shock. What do you mean by that? Talk about that, your decision to use that phrase as a title for this book about art and controversy.
Well, since the book traces, it singles out the major controversies that have come before the public and often have been works, paintings, sculpture, outdoor works, monuments and memorials that in one way or another have shocked a significant part of the population. There are lots and lots of controversies that go on simply inside the art world. And I have not tried to trace them because in 400 pages, I had my hands full recounting and explaining the ones that either ended up in Congress or splashed across the headlines throughout the country.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn of some of the early controversies over art in this country. Some of the memorials, monuments, statues that we now accept as, sort of sacred ground were very controversial when they first went up on the National Mall, as a matter of fact.
Indeed. The first work of sculpture that caused a brouhaha has an interesting story. It's a sculpture that was commissioned by Congress to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the birth of George Washington. He'd been born in 1732. As 1832 approached, people wanted to honor Washington in new ways because he'd already been honored in various ways. And the first thing they wanted to do was actually dig up his body at Mount Vernon and move it to the Capitol and bury it in the crypt of the Capitol. The Washington descendants successfully fought that off because it would have broken Washington's will. He wanted to be buried at Mount Vernon. So then Congress commissioned a sculptor named Horatio Greenough, probably the foremost American sculptor of the day. His studio was in Florence, Italy, so that he could be close to high-quality marble and also have access to the prototypes of sculpture from antiquity. And Greenough produced a seated statue of Washington that was very large and that was nude from the waist up. When it finally arrived at the Capitol in 1842 and had been commissioned to be placed in the rotunda, People were sure that it was so large that they would never be able to fit it into the Capitol, but they did fit it in. And the next problem they discovered was that the lighting, because there was no electricity, so the lighting was by oil lamps, the lighting was so poor that when Greeno arrived a year later, he pleaded that it be moved out onto the East Plaza of the Capitol, whereupon the pigeons repeatedly whitewashed it. That's actually the minor part of the story. The major part has to do with the fact that the head of the statue is a very good resemblance to George Washington. But the body basically resembles the statues of Roman senators and generals that Greeno saw all around him in Rome. And there were numerous complaints about what people referred to as Washington's nakedness. The mayor of New York City came down to have a look, and he remarked that Washington was too prudent and careful of his health to expose himself thus in a climate so uncertain as ours, to say nothing of the indecency of such an exposure. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was just emerging at that time as a novelist, asked whether anyone ever saw Washington naked. It is inconceivable. Mm-hmm. He has no nakedness, but I imagine was born with his clothes on and his hair powdered and made a stately bow on his first appearance in the world. Someone else remarked that Washington was naked except for a napkin to cover his genitals. Well, actually, the drapery from the waist down is really quite full. To see that much of Washington nude rather than seeing him in military dress as the commander of the Revolutionary Army was very, very upsetting to people.
We are talking with Michael Kamen, a professor of history and culture at Cornell University and author of Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. We are talking about controversial art on Talk of the Nation. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. That's 989-TALK. And, it's interesting to me how many of these early controversies revolved around this idea of the people being upset about the motif of Rome and Greece, Greek and Roman motifs being used in so many of the buildings in Washington. They didn't think that was appropriate.
Well, some did and some didn't. Because the young republic was surrounded by a world of monarchies, many people felt that they should look to ancient Greece and Rome, especially the Roman Republic and an image that they had of a very democratic Greece, even though there were slaves in ancient Greece. And therefore, there were strong advocates of having the neoclassical motif, which is why there are so many neoclassical structures, especially among the older ones in Washington. But there were also people who felt quite strongly that there should be a distinctively American way of memorializing people, so that when it was decided to have a memorial to Abraham Lincoln ready for the centennial of his birth in 1909, there were classical architects who vied for the commission. But there were also people who passionately said that Abraham Lincoln didn't know any Greek, and he was a very practical homespun man, and therefore he should be honored with something that would be very utilitarian. And so there was legislation introduced in Congress in 1909 that would honor Lincoln by building a 72-mile highway that would connect Washington with Gettysburg, where, of course, Lincoln gave the famous Gettysburg Address. And that failed to pass in 1909. It was introduced again in 1912, and it was a close vote, but it failed again. And then the commission went for the so-called Greek temple that everyone today assumes is so iconic and could not have turned out otherwise. But when it was completed in 1922, Louis Sullivan, the father of the American skyscraper, or skyscrapers period, proclaimed the death of American architecture. And Frank Lloyd Wright complained bitterly that this was a totally inappropriate way to honor an American figure like Abraham Lincoln. So we've had people on both sides.
How do these early controversies that you've just talked about relate to some of the more contemporary art controversies that we're aware of? In the 90s, for instance, a lot of controversy about the kind of artwork that was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. That was in the media all the time. And you've said in your book that the media can play a large role in these kinds of controversies as well. What's the connection? Where are we at now in terms of art and public art and controversy?
Okay. Well, first, a quick word about the media, because it's important to note, and I talk about this in the book, that in the late 19th and early 20th century, the media covered art controversies, and that provides me with a rich supply of source material. But by the late 20th century, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, the media were often responsible for actually causing controversies. Mm. For example, with Sensation at the Brooklyn Museum, which you referred to a bit ago, New York newspapers got wind of some of the items that were going to be displayed at the
And maybe
Brooklyn
you can
Museum
remind people of what some of those items were that caused problems.
Well, the one that that agitated people the most and set Mayor Giuliani off was a work called The Holy Virgin Mary, by Chris Ofili, a Nigerian artist, and it basically was a black Madonna with shellacked elephant dung across her breasts. And this is a reference to a long-standing tradition in Africa to help nursing women with lactation and putting elephant dung on their breasts. But it was misunderstood as being totally sacrilegious, and it caused Rudy Giuliani to want to close down the Brooklyn Museum. There were also various animals that had been cut in half or displayed in their entirety, works by Damien Hirst, a young British architect who's now no longer quite so young, submerged in large vitrines of formaldehyde. And people were upset by that. And there was another. Go ahead.
I was just going to say these seem like a far cry from what we were talking about when we began the show. These more it seemed like tepid controversies of the early years of our country. But when we come back, we have to take a short break. And so when we come back, I'd like you to make the connection. Culturally, what's going on culturally? Is there a similarity, or is it completely different? What's going on now? So we're going to continue this discussion with Michael Kamen when we return. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about controversial art this hour. When some artworks enter the public sphere, personal taste can become public uproar. My guest is Michael Kamen, author of Visual Shock. And if you'd like to see photographs of some of the art that we're going to mention, go to the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org and tell us what public artworks have moved you to tears or disgust. What do these controversies say about American culture? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and the email address is talk@npr.org. And now, Professor Kamen, maybe you can tell us the connections between the kinds of controversy that we have had over the years, dating back to the early days of this country, to the kinds of controversy we have now, which you were just describing before the break.
Sure. The pivotal decade was the decade of the 1960s, and it was pivotal for a couple of reasons. First of all, because a tremendous number of new schools of art were opened in the United States after World War II. And that meant fierce competition among the young artists emerging from these schools. And they had to differentiate themselves. They had to distinguish themselves in some way. And Roy Lichtenstein, the pop artist, gave an interview not long ago. And he looked back on the 60s and he remarked that the problem for a hopeful scene-making artist in the early 60s was how best to be disagreeable. What he needed was to find a body of subject matter sufficiently odious to offend even lovers of art. So he opted for the vulgarity of comic book images. Now, the other thing that was happening in the, well, two other things in the 60s. One, the Vietnam War. caused many artists to become very politicized, very socially alienated, part of the counterculture, and that prompted them to do a number of shocking things, such as Kate Millett putting an American flag over a toilet bowl and calling it Old Glory Goes to Pot. But the yet another thing, and perhaps the most important one of all, involved the fact that the GSA, the Government Services Administration, decided to open a new program in the early 60s called 1% for Art. And that meant that for every new federal building built from then on, and there was a lot of new federal construction that started in the 60s, 1% of the cost of the building would be set aside so that the architect could choose an artist to do some work of art that would soften the severity of glass and steel structures. And a whole batch of controversies came out of that, especially one in Boston. In fact, the first one exploded in Boston when the John F. Kennedy Federal Building was built in downtown. And Robert Motherwell, an abstract expressionist, was commissioned to do a mural for that building. He did. It was abstract because Motherwell had never done anything but abstract art. But a reporter, there was a rivalry between two Boston newspapers, the Herald and the Globe, and a reporter for the Herald pointed out to a woman who was there for the unveiling that what he saw, he the reporter saw, was John F. Kennedy's brains being blown out and spattering into the air. And he got a nice juicy quote from the woman, took that to the Museum of Fine Arts, relayed it to a curator there who gave another juicy quote, and the Boston Herald had nice black-letter headlines the next day. The Globe, of course, had to top that, and the controversy went on for quite some time until Robert Motherwell could finally persuade people that this mural titled New England Elegy was to commemorate the life of John F. Kennedy and not show his brains being blown out. The National Endowment for the Arts created a similar program late in the 1960s, starting in 1969, with a commission to the sculptor Alexander Calder to do a work for Grand Rapids, Michigan called Grand Vitesse, a play on words on Calder's part. And that became controversial for a variety of reasons. First, because Calder lived in Connecticut, had a home in France. The work was going to have to be fabricated in France, and people in Grand Rapids wanted to know why there was no sculptor from the upper Midwest or even from Michigan who couldn't have been chosen. Why this Francophile? And then the work is very large. It's very red, as people will see on your website. And the natives in Grand Rapids were afraid that they would become laughingstock of the country. So at first they protested. Gerald Ford was the representative of that congressional district at the time, and he became persuaded that it was an interesting work of art when people began to come from all over the upper Midwest to see it. Hmm. Grand Rapids had not historically been a tourist mecca.
So these controversies sometimes can be good for art or can draw people in to see it, more people come to see it.
Over and over and over again, it's turned out that the most controversial exhibitions have been the ones that have drawn in the unprecedentedly large crowds. This was true of the motorcycles at the Guggenheim Museum in 1998. It was true of Sensation at the Brooklyn Museum in 99. It was true of an exhibition about the American flag in American art.
I want to get to the discussion about the motorcycle exhibition in a moment, but I do want to get some calls in here. So let me take a call first from Charlie. He's calling from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
Go ahead.
That is my question.
I'm afraid we're having trouble hearing you, Charlie. I think we have some phone trouble there. Let's try David in Rockford, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi. My question is for the Professor Kamen. Good afternoon. I would like to know, how is the funding for the National Endowment for Arts affected by these controversial artworks that we're actually funding through federal government? And if it is affected, does the current administration and who's in charge in Congress, are they making the decisions on how much money goes to the National Endowment for Arts? And what do you see as the future in that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Congress tried when the Republicans achieved a majority in Congress in 1994. Newt Gingrich attempted to shut down the National Endowment for the Arts entirely. That did not succeed, but the congressional committee has to approve the annual appropriation for NEA, and they radically cut NEA's budget. They also changed the formula whereby NEA in Washington would receive much less, and a larger amount would be distributed to be awarded locally, on the assumption that people at the grassroots have a better sense of the kind of art that's appropriate to their communities. And NEA's budget has been quite modest for the past decade. When Sid Yates, a congressman from Illinois, in fact, passed away, he had been the great champion of NEA in Congress. And there really hasn't been a strong champion. But NEA has tried to avoid controversy, has been much more careful in having its proposals peer-reviewed with a lot of input from local communities to make sure that they could minimize controversies of the sort that Grand Vitesse caused.
We are talking with Professor Michael Kamen about his new book, Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. Have you seen any works of art that you have found to be too controversial, or works of art that have moved you and others have not liked? We'd be interested in hearing your stories. Again, the number 1-800-989-8255. And we're going to go to Carolyn now. She's in Barneveld, Wisconsin. Hi, Carolyn.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Taking my call. I was recently at the Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis. At least I think that was the museum I attended. I was there on business and went through the exhibit, and at the end there was a sculpture of a doe and a woman laying on the ground, and her foot was either inserted into or extruding from the rear orifice of the deer, and I found that extremely offensive and disturbing. And I was watching children looking at this too, and parents unsure how to, you know, maybe address what they were seeing. I don't know who the artist was. I needed to leave the presence of that sculpture just because I did find it so strange and disturbing. So to your discussion and your guest's topic about controversial art, I'm wondering how that piece of work, if you're familiar with it, was accepted in the community, and what advice you may have for parents who take their children to museums. I grew up in New York and went to all the museums in the city, and even in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Museum, and never had a situation where my parents had to, you know, try and interpret or explain to a child what they were seeing. So I will take your comments off the air.
Carolyn, I just have one question. Are you still there?
Yes.
I just have one question. Would you, because of your own feeling of discomfort with that, would you feel that that you wouldn't want that work of art on display for others because you are
I would want a parent to have knowledge of it within the exhibit, so when they turned the corner and the child was there, that they weren't, you know, in a situation where, you know, they had some warning, just like with television and media today. I think it's appropriate to put some ratings, perhaps, or some sort of preparedness for someone in exhibit that some people might find something disturbing. And I realize there's a broad spectrum of opinions on what is art and what might be offensive. But from my description, perhaps your guest knows of the piece and can speak more to that specifically.
All right. Thanks for your call, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Professor Kamen?
I don't know that particular piece. The policies of museums vary from one to the next, but it's been common practice for about the past 15 years for museums to warn parents that a particular exhibit, not usually an individual work of art, but that some part of an exhibit may be inappropriate for children under the age of 12, or in the case of Sensation at the Brooklyn Museum, it was actually a clever way to draw people in. Signs were posted saying that no one under the age of 18, anyone under the age of 18 would have to be accompanied by an adult. Well, needless to say, lots and lots of teenagers asked adults to accompany them to that exhibit. There's the Robert Mapplethorpe photographs that caused such a stir in Congress, and again brought about threats to curtail NEA. The Mapplethorpe exhibit had some very beautiful still lifes. It had some very elegant portraits, but it did have a portfolio, an ex-portfolio, as it was called, that involved the homoerotic subculture of which Mapplethorpe was a part. And there were warnings to parents about the inappropriateness of taking children in to see that. So this has become more and more the norm, but they don't usually single out individual works of art. You may have noted just about a month ago, there was quite a ruckus in a Dallas, in Dallas, Texas, where an art teacher took a fifth grade class to the Dallas Art Museum. She had carefully chosen the route that she wanted to take them through the museum, but they the children did see a couple of nude paintings and a nude statue from 330 BC of a an ancient Greek athlete. And a fifth grader came home and told her mother that she had seen a naked man in the museum. And as a result, the art teacher actually has been suspended. She's been replaced in her job. And the ACLU is bringing action. And the issue is unresolved. So there are ongoing problems with what children should or should not see. And it's often a matter of the taste of a particular locality or community that determines whether or not there's actually going to be a controversy.
Michael Kamen is the author of Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call from Josh, and he is calling from Fenton, Michigan. Hi, Josh. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering actually if your guest could comment on a piece of art that I had seen probably about a year ago titled Piss Christ. It was literally like a crucifix immersed in a tank of urine, and I was wondering if artists do this kind of thing just to get attention, just to make a name for themselves, or is it something that, because in all the comments that I found about it, the artist could never justify why he actually did the piece.
And did you find it offensive, Josh, when you saw it?
I didn't find it particularly offensive. I thought it was interesting and a little bit maybe over the top. I really saw it as an attention seeker rather than a genuine piece of art.
Interesting question. Thanks so much for calling, Josh. I mean, have we gotten to this point now with art that part of the controversial art that we're seeing now in contemporary America is to get attention?
Yes. That's absolutely true. In the case of the Piss Christ, it's a very well-known work by Andres Serrano, a photographer who was raised Roman Catholic. And if you didn't know that it was his own urine in the vitrine, it looked like bubbly champagne and actually creates a very warm glow. But because of the title and the wall text, when it was first displayed in 1989 and 1990, it also created tremendous controversy. Senator Alphonse D'Amato of New York gave a speech in which he expressed his outrage, and that image also contributed to threats against NEA. Serrano actually was doing a series of photographs involving bodily fluids. So there's one, he did one called Milk and Blood that's basically white on one side and red on the other. He actually did a photograph of his own ejaculation that looks like a comet streaking across the sky.
But let me ask you, what the public is to make of this kind of art that is deliberately intended to provoke controversy? I mean, how do you make a thoughtful judgment about that in terms of the art itself?
Well, I think the key question is whether the art is displayed in a museum or whether it's public sculpture that's outside. No one has to go into a museum, and all of these exhibitions are reviewed. And the reviews warn people of either dead animals in formaldehyde or works that might be perceived as offensive to someone's religion. The difficulty arises with works like Tilted Ark by Richard Serra and other public works that cannot be avoided because you have to pass them on your way to and from work. And that, of course, gets into the whole question of whether or not public money, taxpayers' money, should be spent for works that people find ugly and offensive. But
let me just ask you one last
in museums. Yeah.
One last question. We just have about a minute left. So briefly, just in the end, do you think that these controversies are good for art, or ultimately?
Dwight Eisenhower was present for the 25th anniversary of the Museum of Modern Art in 1954, and he said that art controversies are exceedingly healthy because they stimulate public thinking about what the public wants art to be. And I basically agree with that, and I think that whenever these controversies have occurred, they have prompted people to think about whether traditional criteria such as beauty should continue to be used, or whether there are other criteria such as commentary on social ills of our time.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Should be a problem.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Professor Kamen.
Sure thing.
Michael Kamen is Professor of American History and Culture at Cornell University. His latest book is Visual Shock, A History of Art Controversies in American Culture. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.